Chapter 18, False Ideas Disseminated by Jews. 1. The love of money is the root of all evil. This oft-quoted passage from the Bible has been swallowed in total by practically everyone without ever stopping to examine its meaning. When it is examined for what it is really worth, it is found to be patently false. It is not money, nor the love of money, that is the root of all evil, but the root of all evil is the perfidious Jew. Money is not only a medium of exchange, it is a necessary and useful tool in the wheels of commerce in our modern civilization. If we did not have such a means of exchange, modern business, progress, and in fact, civilization as a whole, would be irreparably set back and tremendously handicapped. To the average breadwinner and to the average family, the acquiring and earning of money is the means of acquiring security, of obtaining all the necessities of life, such as food, shelter, clothing, entertainment, education, in fact, everything required for a decent living. To impugn a man for pursuing a trade, a profession, or business that will earn him the money to take care of himself and his family is about as idiotic as to deny him the right to live. No, indeed, there is nothing wrong with a man making as much money as he possibly can, and providing for himself, for his family, and his heirs, to the best of his ability. It is, in fact, those energetic and restless men of ability, such as Henry Ford, who have created the most and have also given the greatest benefits to our race, to our nation, and to civilization. This whole idea is basically as wrong as so many other quotations in the New Testament, which discourages a man from pursuing those natural instincts endowed to him by nature for his own survival. Among these basic instincts are the will to survive, the basic urge to fight, to preserve himself, his family, and his property from any direction, the urge to build, to produce, to make, and to improve. The idea that money in itself is evil, or the love thereof, is along the same lines as some of the other bad advice that Christ gave when he said, "Think not of the morrow. Look at the lily in the field. It toils not. Yet Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these," etc. Or, "Look at the birds. They toil not. Yet the heavenly Father takes care of them," etc. This is all real bad advice. In the first place, the birds work hard to do all those things that are required to feed themselves, to build their nests, to raise their young, and to perpetuate their species. Those that do not do so perish forthwith. The lily in the field and other plants, in their own way, have to compete vigorously against other plants for water and nutrition. if they don't, they get crowded out and are replaced by more healthy and more vigorous plants. All species of nature, whether they are plants, birds, animals, or mankind itself, are in competition with other life. It is the strong, the brave, the vigorous, the courageous, the energetic that survive, while the weak fall by the wayside. Again, this debilitating advice was solely meant for the Gentiles. It was designed to set them back as much as possible, to clear the field for the treacherous Jew, who will then have an easier time of it in stealing all the wealth of the world from the white race and consolidating it in the hands of his own race. 2. The race situation is getting so bad in this country, I am thinking of leaving the United States and moving my family to Australia in the near future. Many good white people in this country are thinking along those lines. It is a completely wrong solution to a bad situation. For years now, the white race has been fleeing before the niggers and the Jews, and it has gotten us nowhere. The answer is not to flee, but to stand up and fight. We should be pursuing, not fleeing. We are either going to fight and win the battle in the United States, or we will not win it anywhere. If the best and most race-conscious people flee from this country and leave the rest to mongrelize with the niggers, this wonderful United States of ours will certainly go down the drain. Once the Jews have accomplished that much, you can be sure that they will use the full weight and power of this wealthy country to impose mongrelization in Australia, South Africa, or any other part of the world. No, the answer is not to leave the U.S. The answer is to organize, to unite the white people, to practice racial loyalty, to drive the Jews from power, to ship the niggers back to Africa, and to firmly grasp the reins of power in the hands of a determined, united, race-conscious white government. 3. Our laws and constitution are founded on Christianity. It is amazing indeed how many white Americans are laboring under this erroneous conclusion and deluding themselves and others by repeating it in parrot-like fashion. When asked just what Christian principles our laws are based on, they are stumped for answer. And for good reasons. When we examine what were some of the basic Christian principles that were enunciated by Christ in the Sermon on the Mount, for instance, we find such principles as turn the other cheek, love your enemies, sell all thou hast, and give it to the poor, resist not evil, judge not. If our Lord were based on these principles, we would, of course, have nothing but anarchy and mayhem. If we just take, for instance, the principle, resist not evil, we would have no law enforcement agencies, we would have no army, navy, or air force to defend us from foreign enemies. We would, of course, be completely defenseless and would soon be destroyed. No nation was ever built on such an impossible foundation, least of all America. Nor was America built on the principle of turn the other cheek. No, indeed. When during our early and most constructive years, The white men from Europe came to these savage and inhospitable shores. They drove back the red man to claim this land for their very own. They did indeed not turn the other cheek. In fact, it was their aggressiveness and their loyalty to their own race in driving back the Indians and killing them when necessary to take over their land that laid the foundation for the building of this great country. When the white man then forged onward and westward, he again fought and killed the Indians and drove them from the land. Without a doubt, the winning of the West is one of the most romantic and constructive episodes in the history of mankind. It was the white man at his best, aggressive, fighting, conquering territory, breaking new land, building homes, building cities, building railroads in new territory, and thereby creating a great nation. No. Let us not delude ourselves. There was no suicidal or idiotic Christian principles involved in this great burst of creative and constructive energy that the white race pursued. It was a glorious example of the free play of the forces of nature at their best. The white man, unfettered and uncluttered with a lot of silly ideas about compassion and humanitarianism, fought and drove his way westward, and thereby built a great new white nation that today encompasses half the productive strength and half the wealth of the world. As far as our government and laws are concerned, they owe next to nothing to Christianity, but practically everything to the great Roman civilization that preceded us by more than a millennium and a half ago. The very word republic is taken from the Roman word res publica. The republican form of government is modeled strictly from the Roman forms. Our law courts are modeled after the courts of Rome, or our European forebears, who copied them from the Roman model with certain modifications. In fact, our founding fathers, when discussing and debating the form of government to institute, continuously went back to Roman history for experience and example. The facts overwhelmingly point to our judiciary, our Congress, our executive, being the benefactors to the great systems of law and government that the Romans had instituted during their epoch in history. That is why we find that anyone who studies for the legal profession today is required to take Latin, since so many of the legal terms used are best stated in the original Latin from which the legal concepts originated. The Romans were, without doubt, the creators of the finest organization of law and government the world has ever seen, and we are blessed to be the heirs of that great tradition and civilization. We should, therefore, set this matter straight once and for all. Neither our American government nor are our laws in the U.S. based on Christian principles. In fact, when all these new Christian principles spread throughout the Roman Empire like a plague, the Roman civilization collapsed. And no wonder, when we consider how devastatingly destructive and suicidal was this new philosophy of love your enemies, turn the other cheek, judge not, resist not evil. No, indeed, America was neither built on nor based on Christian principles. On the contrary, it was first of all built on the creative energy of the white race, giving free play to its natural instincts, and secondly, its government and laws were built on the experience and the rich legacy left us by Imperial Rome. 4. There is nothing you can do about it. As the Jews push further and further with their various programs for our enslavement, such programs as massive forced busing of our children, higher and more confiscatory taxes, the mongrelization of our white race, etc., we find our people almost universally throwing up their hands and saying, there is nothing you can do about it. This is, of course, another example of the Jew skillfully implanting in our minds the age-old military strategy of, if you can get your enemy to think they are defeated before the battle even starts, then they are as good as defeated. This strategy is as old as the hills, but people are still falling for it. Despite all the laws and idiotic court decisions, there are many things that you, a white American citizen, can do. The first thing you can do is to take a positive, courageous attitude. The second thing you can do is to make up your mind that you are not going to be enslaved and that you are going to fight. And the fact is, the situation is far from hopeless. You have many resources available to you with which to wage the battle. After all, we the white Americans outnumber the Jews 30-1 and the niggers 7-1. Now just remember that. Furthermore, we have available to us all those tools and means that the Jews, actually a small minority, have used in their favor for our enslavement. The number of things you can do are almost unlimited, and here are but a few suggestions. 1. Form a local protest committee or organization to promote and pursue those political ends that you think are desirable and in opposition to those that you deem undesirable. 2. Along the same lines, form a political party or a political organization to create a power or influence block. 3. Run some good candidates for office, or better still, run for office yourself. 4. Compile propaganda leaflets and literature and get a group to distribute them as widely as possible. 5. Organize and promote massive resistance to such laws as forced busing of your school children. 6. Write letters of protest to your congressman and other elected officials. This is probably one of the weaker forms of action you can take. 7. Write letters to the editors of your local newspapers and encourage others to do the same. 8. Form a telephone committee and organize local meetings of protest. 9. Give speeches in protest of those laws that are bad and in favor of such changes as you think should be made. 10. If everything else should fail, you still have the right to do the same things as our founding fathers did in 1776. If you are being enslaved under a tyrannical government, using law and order as a guise, remember that your right to life, liberty, and property supersedes all other secondary laws, and you have a right to overthrow such a tyranny by force if necessary. Historically, when tyrants have sought to enslave them, free men have resorted to force of arms in order to remain free. Above all, the most significant and meaningful action you can take is to organize the Church of the Creator in your area. Whereas attempting to directly fight the United Nations, school busing, confiscatory taxation, and 1,001 other atrocities the Jews have heaped upon us might seem the most obvious course to take, it is not, however, the most effective. In most of these things, we are fighting the effects instead of destroying the cause. Let us never forget the cause of most of our troubles, and the root of all evil is the perfidious Jew. Therefore, in building the Church of the Creator nationwide, and then expanding worldwide, we are destroying the basic cause of all our problems. As I have said time and time again, the first and most important step is straightening out the white man's thinking. Once we have accomplished this much, it will be relatively easy to organize and unite the white race from there on out. And overcoming the Jews and the niggers will be child's play. So let us proceed. Remember, the most effective and meaningful action you can take is to organize a unit of the Church of the Creator in your area, or join such a group if it already exists. Then go to work and recruit, preach, promote and disseminate the information, program, and ideology contained in this book. Help bring your white racial comrades back to their senses and unite them in the fight for the survival of their own race. It is our common objective, in which you must help, to have one or more copies of this book in the home of every white family in America, and finally, in all the world. We can do it, we must do it, and we will do it. So let us proceed. 5. The means is as important as the end itself. Wrong as wrong can be, this bit of nonsense has been probably more strongly promoted by kosher conservatives than any other group. Here's what the Jews themselves say about this matter in Protocol 15. How far-seeing were our learned elders in ancient times when they said that to attain a serious end, it behooves not to stop at any means or to count the victims sacrificed for the sake of the end. Whereas we despise the protocols in total and their objectives, we cannot deny the keen insight into history and human nature that are exhibited throughout the protocols, lessons deduced from experience and history. Let us take, for example, the case where we are engaged in a war with the enemy. A war that means either our death or our survival. In such a war, all measures are used, as for example, deception, surprise, killing, bombing, destroying the enemy's food supply, destroying their cities, etc. I am not formulating a new theory herewith, but merely stating the facts of history as they have unfolded over the last several thousand years. Yet we find within our own country, when it comes to taking such measures as are necessary for our own survival, the survival of the white race, we find a multitude of humanitarians preaching brotherly love, compassion, Christian charity, goodwill, unselfishness, kindness, tenderness, tolerance, generosity, and all the other sops of human kindness ad nauseam. We soon find our hands so completely tied that we cannot do those things that we should do in order to protect ourselves from the destruction that the Jews have prepared for us. In matters of survival of the white race, and in matters of politics, we should use the same cold, clear reasoning as is employed in times of war, and forget this nonsense about Christian charity. We must remember that there is no higher law in nature than self-preservation and the perpetuation of our species. 6. Promise just what the people want and make beautiful speeches, then do just the opposite. The Jews have abused this political ruse so often and for such a long time that it would seem almost self-evident that the white people would catch on, but apparently they haven't. When Kennedy ran for election, he made a big issue of arming this country to become so powerful that none would dare attack us. After he was elected, he immediately set about disarming us and leaving us naked and defenseless before our enemies. With the Jew Adam Hamalinsky taking over our Defense Department and McNamara playing the frontline stooge, this trio soon set about wrecking what inadequate defenses we had at this point in history. This is just one instance of lying perfidy. There are many others in the few short years Kennedy was in power. When Nixon was elected, he made great promises about his opposition to school integration and busing. However, no sooner had he been elected, but he set in motion massive government machinery and massive amounts of taxpayers' money to integrate our schools, bus our children around like a herd of cattle, and implement the Jewish program of race mongrelization. President Johnson was no better. He promised government economy by pretending to be switching off light bulbs in the White House to save taxpayers' money. Immediately thereupon, he launched the greatest spending spree in history up to that time and increased the federal debt and government expenditures beyond anything that had ever been seen before. These three presidents are cited merely as typical examples. They themselves did many other acts of treachery that gave the lie to their previous promises. In this they were no different than presidents that came before them. I cite these few examples merely out of thousands of other promises that were made, only to be broken. We should realize, of course, that this is an old Jewish trait. When Johnson or Kennedy or Nixon perform these acts of treachery, all detrimental to the white race, they were not acting as representatives of the white race at all, but as cheap, degenerate stooges for the treacherous Jew that was manipulating the country's destiny. Using these stooges as frontmen on the stage to cover up their treachery. In referring to this, here is their quote from the Eighth Protocol in reference to appointing white stooges to positions in government. We shall put them in the hands of persons whose past and reputation are such that between them and the people lies an abyss, persons who, in case of disobedience, must face criminal charges. This in order to make them defend our interests to their last gasp. 7. All men are created equal. When the Founding Fathers wrote the Declaration of Independence, they were striving for a ringing message that would arouse the men to fight and join their cause. The Jews, who were at that time disseminating revolutionary ideas in Europe in general, and in France in particular, were broadcasting the old catchwords of liberty, fraternity, equality. This was in preparation for the French Revolution and other revolutions that they were planning. America was not immune to this Jewish propaganda, and many of these ideas were making headway in America as well. It was, therefore, a great tragedy when our Founding Fathers embedded and wrote into the Declaration of Independence the deceptive Jewish catchphrase, "All men are created equal." This obviously false and idiotic statement has been aggressively exploited from that day on. It has plagued us ever since and been a tremendously powerful weapon in the hands of the Jews, the revolutionaries, the liberals, and the anarchists. It is so obviously false, it would seem no refutation is necessary. But not so. It has been quoted so often by so many of our false leaders that, like the Sermon on the Mount and so many other ideas that are patently contrary to all reason, it has been accepted by the majority of white people as being a truism. The white people should really know better than this. Looking back over their own glorious history, the lesson of the superiority of the white race over others is so obvious that it should need no explanation. Not only that, but on the very face of it, even among the same race, men are patently different. Some are highly intelligent, some are tall, some are strong, some are weak, some are idiots. The list of differences is endless. Nor are men ever born in the same stations of life. For instance, a baby born to a millionaire is born into a different station and environment and will immediately have different opportunities for development than, say, for instance, a baby born into a home whose parents are poverty-stricken and of low intelligence. A child born into a musical household. For example, the family of Johann Strauss would have an altogether different inclination, environment, beginning, and so on, than, say, would a baby born into a missionary family living among the Indians in the jungles of the Amazon. We could, of course, list endless examples to substantiate this further. In any case, this false, misleading, and untrue statement has been a tremendously powerful wedge for the Jews to drive home their campaign of mongrelization. Upon this false premise is based the second false premise. If the niggers were only given the same opportunity and environment, they would perform the same as the white people. Therefore, we should drive full speed ahead towards a program of mongrelization. The fact that the niggers are inherently inferior to the white race in intelligence, in mentality, in their lack of cultural creativity, in the fact that they are lazy and shiftless, the fact that their morals are of a completely different and lower level than that of the white man, and endless other differences, of which the color difference is the least, all these are ignored. The fact is that men are not created equal, are not born equal, do not develop equally. There is a tremendous difference in their contributions to civilization and mankind. We must therefore get back to reality and destroy this false myth. Nature herself has created all creatures unequal in a million different ways. We proud members of the white race must remember one thing. Our racial identity is the holiest thing that nature has bestowed upon us, and we must preserve it at all costs. 8. Don't talk about politics and religion, for politics and religion don't mix. Whoever has control of the government of a nation and the very nature of that government is the most important single fact bearing upon the destiny of that race or nation. Political control determines all other factors such as economics, education, security, progress, culture, and just about every other important aspect. In the protocols, the Jews point out that they would like to have the goyim mind occupied by all kinds of trivialities, so that he will never come around to considering the vital issues that affect his destiny. It is, of course, of utmost importance that we talk about politics, and even more important, that we discuss religion. Our life is based on our religious outlook, then we must make sure that total control is wrested from the destructive Jews and reclaimed into the hands of loyal white leaders. Whether or not this is done is also largely affected by the religious complexion of the people. Government is usually a reflection of the philosophy, religious attitude, and outlook of the people themselves. It therefore behooves us to get our religious thinking straight. We must realize that the preservation, promotion, and protection of our great white race is the most important and most holy cause to which we can devote our lives. We must then translate this outlook into political action and political control of our governments. Control vested completely in the hands of loyal racist white leaders. Religion and politics are inseparable and most vital for our survival. 9. We are all individuals. This contrary idea, strongly fostered by the Jews, is as divisive as it is destructive. The fact of the matter is, we are all members of a particular society, striving together for our own total betterment. The whole progress of mankind and civilization can be measured by the increased ability of man to create and build a social organization. From the time that man began to subdivide the different tasks of growing food, weaving cloth, manufacturing, transportation, medical care, etc. From that time on, a man began to lift himself by the bootstraps from his jungle existence into a modern, productive society. With this comes the willingness to sacrifice his own interests for the good of his race and his society as a whole. This is one of the remarkably outstanding creative traits of the white race, and this is why he has been able to accomplish so much. Were we to revert to the idea that we are all individuals, with every man for himself, rather than fulfilling his obligations to his family, to his local town, to his country, and to his race in general, society as a whole, and civilization in total, would soon collapse. We are by no means individuals. Every act we perform affects our families, affects our community, affects our nation, and affects our race. The more we realize our obligations to all the different contracts that we have, the more creative and more effective a society we will build. Should we think of ourselves purely as individuals, we would soon revert back to the caveman stage and wipe out all the progress we have made over the thousands of years. 10. The only salvation for this nation is a real two-party system. Wrong. The two-party system is an ideal Jewish device to divide and conquer. It splits the white vote and gives the Jews and the niggers the deciding leverage to win elections. Furthermore, it is basically opposed to the leadership principle and serves to immobilize, divide, and fragment the white race. Instead of promoting unity and progress, it enmeshes its unfortunate victims in an endless hassle. Two or more opposing factions will bicker and argue endlessly over nitpicking trivialities, usually ending up in a compromise, a stalemate, or a deadlock. The real answer is the time-proven system embodied in the leadership principle. 11. The ballot is the only weapon the people possess. The ballot is probably the most ineffective weapon the people possess. The people can do a number of things that are more effective from our political point of view. They can form organizations, political and otherwise. They can change the system of government. As a last resort, they can overthrow their tyrants by force if necessary. If threatened with destruction, a race is not only entitled to, but obligated as the highest right in nature to use any means possible to overthrow and destroy their oppressors. The law of the right of survival of the species is the highest law in nature. 12. Are you going to condemn all the Jews? There are good and bad people in all races, and we shouldn't condemn a whole race. There might be good and bad people in all races, but if there are any good Jews, from a white man's point of view, they have yet to be found and identified. To be a Jew means to be a follower of the Talmud, and any follower of the Talmud is a co-conspirator in a vicious program designed to destroy the Gentiles in general and the white race in particular. to exempt any of the Jews from responsibility in this conspiracy would be like exempting the individual participants in any army fighting against you. Whereas there might be different degrees of involvement in the Jewish hierarchy, different ranks and command posts, nevertheless, all the members of the Jewish race, in one way or another, actively participate in the war against the rest of humanity. It is rather strange that the same people who are continually offering apologies and exceptions for the Jews are not at all concerned about the way that warfare has been carried on, say, for instance, in World War I or World War II, when, for example, Hamburg was bombed viciously by the Allied Air Forces, who killed 50,000 white people in Hamburg in one night, including old people, women, little babies, children, pregnant women. These same apologists seem to be totally unconcerned about whether perhaps some of those white people were murdered without reason. Nor do we hear any cries of protest when the Allies, under the control of the Jews, launched a vicious 3-day incineration air raid on the beautiful city of Dresden and burned, cremated and incinerated 300,000 people in one of the most vicious and atrocious massacres in history. Again, these same people seem completely unconcerned as to whether or not all of these Germans, or any of them in fact, were guilty or deserving of such a horrible fate. The fact of the matter is, none of them were guilty of any crime whatsoever. The only thing the Germans can be accused of is that they had the courage to try to shake off the Jew and defend their race and their nation from the international Jewish conspiracy. For this brave and courageous war, the Germans should be highly commended, not condemned. 13. The phony fight technique. The Jews are real fond of getting the white race enmeshed in some silly fight or argument in which they state the issues and the answers. No matter which side you take, both sides are destructive to our cause. Not only do the Jews use this trick to confuse white people and waste their time bickering and stirring up animosity, but while the white race is wasting tremendous amounts of energy, wallowing in a useless hassle, the Jews feel quite safe that none of that energy will be directed against them. The Jews are continuously setting up political parties or opposition groups that achieve no other purpose than destroying each other, while the Jews walk away with the spoils of war. In our political system, they set up, for instance, the Republican and the Democratic parties, having thereby set up a so-called two-party system. They then make sure they control both sides. Then they make a big to-do about how wonderful is the two-party system, how it exemplifies the American tradition, and how it is almost holy. Controlling both sides either way, no matter who wins, the white people lose, and the Jew is the sure winner in every contest. There are so many variations of this phony fight technique that a whole book could be written on it. We will just quote a few examples. outside of the many political factions that uselessly fight each other. In this country, we have the phony fight foreign wars that the Jews have involved us in. There was, for instance, the Korean War, in which the Jews controlled the American forces, and they also controlled the North Korean forces. The object was not victory, but confusion and the draining of American resources financially, in manpower, and in world prestige. But above all, the objective was to have the colored races kill as many young white boys in the prime of their manhood as possible, thereby depleting the strength of our white race. Since the white goy and America were too stupid to catch on, the Jews made a huge replay of the same action all over again in Vietnam. And so the favorite Jewish pastime of killing white Gentiles goes on at a more murderous pace than ever. 40 multiply contradictory and confusing arguments on 1,000 issues, all of little importance. In the protocols, the Jews state that they will confuse and confound the mind of the goy with all sides of 1,000 different issues. The goy will be so confused and lost in the wilderness of contradictory arguments that they will throw up their hands in despair. Jewish control of the communications media gives them an excellent opportunity to pursue this method of mind pollution. The fact that the arguments disseminated are illogical, contradictory, and completely ridiculous makes absolutely no difference. The purpose is to so confuse the white Gentiles that they will be completely paralyzed in pursuing any course of action which might stop the advancement of the Jewish program. 15. Jews posing as Gentiles, Jews changing their names. A chameleon device oft used by the Jews is the trick of changing their names and posing as Gentiles. They are especially fond of picking a real good Anglo-Saxon name, such as a Scotch name or an Irish name, or one that is unmistakably English, so that they are automatically looked upon as being non-Jewish. A few examples are Douglas Dillon, Douglas Fairbanks, and thousands of others. Under this guise, they can boldly pursue the Jewish cause with little risk of being detected as one of the so-called chosen. 16. Using mulattoes with a preponderance of white blood to represent the typical nigger. There is now a massive drive on to mongrelize the white race and pump the black blood of Africa into the veins of white America. Every possible program and means is being used. One of the tricks the Jews use is to show these refugees from the jungles of Africa on television, interspersed with a group of white people. If an ad is shown in a dialogue or newspaper, there is always a group of 2, 3, or 4 white boys and girls, and one little nigger in their midst. However, if they showed the real pure, undiluted black nigger, he would be too repulsive for the white American public to accept. To overcome this, they always select models that are not niggers at all, but mulattoes, with a preponderance of white blood in them. In fact, most of them are more likely 3/4 white or 7/8 white. These are then passed off to the American audiences as the typical nigger. People such as Lena Horne, Jim Brown in the entertainment field, or Senator Brooks in the political field have more white blood in them than they do black blood, and what intelligence, if any, they have was derived from the white side. The Jews pretend this is a typical black and point to them with pride as proving that the niggers are every bit as capable as the white people. This, of course, is a perversion of nature and a gross and mischievous insult to the white race. 17. Black is beautiful. This slogan, promoted by the Jews, has no more truth in it when applied to people than it does when applied to dirty laundry. The truth is that all the people of the world have not only a high respect for, but envy of the white race. The desire among the colored peoples of the world to be lighter skinned is almost universal. Thus, many aborigines paint themselves white. The peoples of India have developed a rigid caste system in which the distinction is the lighter the skin, the higher the caste, and the darker the skin, the lower the caste. Not only that, but many colored races have blue-eyed gods as their idols. Even the Japanese design their dolls with white faces and blue eyes, both of which are typically un-Japanese. Black niggers, both here and in Africa, who are social climbers, consider it the height of their ambition to marry a white woman, and some Jewish outfit in this country is constantly milking the blacks by selling them some sort of pomade guaranteed to whiten their skin. It is ironical that the people of the white race have had their brains so polluted with Jewish racial lies that of all the peoples of the world, they are the least aware of the great outstanding worth of their white racial heritage. Nevertheless, the colored races of the world are fully aware of what they have not and are not. 18. The policy of reversal. This refers to the shifty Jewish trick of making things not only appear different from what they are, but of making them appear exactly the opposite of what they are. For instance, the Jewish-controlled government of Russia is portrayed as being anti-Jewish and persecuting the Jews. Jews themselves are the most fanatically racist-minded people on the face of the earth, yet are portrayed as being violently against racism. Racial integration of our schools, which is actually destroying the white race, is being publicized with great fanfare as getting quality education to everyone. Increased income taxes, which fan the flames of inflation, are portrayed as a means of stopping inflation. The number of tricks the Jews have up their sleeve in this field is almost endless. 19. The Jews are the chosen people. This is one of the oldest hoaxes in history that the Jews have successfully perpetrated on the white people by foisting their Jewish Old Testament upon the religions of the white people. The Old Testament, written by the Jews themselves, keeps pounding away at the theme that they have a special contract with God. They claim that God just smiled benevolently on the Jews while they went about their dirty business slaying, looting, and murdering all other tribes, that the white race should have incorporated this treacherous Jewish history, embodying the chosen people hoax, as part of their own religion, is one of the great perversions of nature, and one of the strange tragedies of history. For this stupid mistake, the white race has paid dearly. 20. The use of pollsters to confuse what is passed off as popular public opinion. Having a complete monopoly of the propaganda media, the Jews set up public opinion polls to tell the people what their opinion is. After they have thoroughly doctored and rigged these opinions to conform with their version of what public opinion should be, they then give these polls wide and universal publicity. They thereby create the illusion of support for their myriad of extremely unpopular Jewish programs. On the other hand, the illusion is created that there is no support for those policies that in reality would benefit the white race. These phony opinion makers will always show Jewish ideas more popular than they really are, and will show white racial ideas to be less popular than they really are. Thus, various Jewish ideas, such as foreign aid, race mixing, high taxes, gun control, legalized pot, etc., will be shown to be popular, or at least gaining in popularity. On the other hand, such white values as morality, segregation, repatriation of the nigger to Africa, white racial unity, self-reliance, aversion to pot, promiscuity, and pornography will be shown as old-fashioned and square. The Jewish press will portray them as something the young people are abandoning, and in general, they will be portrayed as being unpopular and steadily losing ground. This deceitful Jewish tool also is a powerful weapon for helping swing elections in their favor. Unfortunately, too many white people have had their brains so polluted with Jewish propaganda as to be unable to see through these phony pollsters. Too often, they will vote in the direction the Jews tell them is the popular so-called opinion of the day. 21. Phony labels and smear trigger words. The all-pervasive Jewish propaganda networks, in short order, build up certain words that heap hate, contempt, and derision upon those who are tagged with these loathsome labels. By means of massive repetition, people automatically associate evil and malevolence surrounding anybody tagged with these trigger words without reasoning what the real meaning might be behind them. The word racist is such an example, whereas the real meaning of the word should be someone that practices racial loyalty, a noble attribute indeed. Yet today, because of Jewish propaganda efforts, it is regarded by millions as a description to be shunned and detested. Another word is the term Nazi. Since the Jews well realize that the program as set forth by Adolf Hitler in National Socialist Germany was a serious threat to the Jewish conspiracy, they want to frighten everybody away from even looking into and studying the cure. Hence the massive smear campaign against Hitler and the Nazi philosophy. 30 years after his death, the name of Adolf Hitler is still the most hateful phrase in the Jewish lexicon. In the religious field, we find similar, ready-made trigger smear words. The word atheist is such a term. Instead of open-mindedly considering the evidence and allowing the free play of common sense and reasoning, such a sound, rational course is battered to the ground and short-circuited by the massive use of name-calling and smear words. Some others are the words antichrist, godless, blasphemy, and heresy. On the other hand, when the Jews seek to promote the deceitful, destructive program that plunders and cheats the white race, they dress them in glamorous, high-sounding labels, usually garnished with a flavor of humanitarianism. The United Nations, a plan of Jewish world government designed to enslave the Gentiles of the world, is such a phrase. Making the world safe for democracy is another such phrase. What these programs really mean is fighting destructive world wars in which one coalition of white nations destroys another group of white nations. Thereby, they ensure the advancement of Jewish control over their victims and ensure, furthermore, that the Jews will be able to plan another such deadly war. Another is racial brotherhood, which really means that while the Jew is mongrelizing the white race, he wants to make sure that there will be no resistance and no opposition. Other such deceptive labels are urban renewal, interdenominational faith, desegregation, and moderates. 22. Cry persecution. Throughout their history, the Jews have used the cry of persecution with admirable skill. Being extremely parasitic in nature, they will bore into the host nation in which they live, plunder it dry, destroy its morals, undermine its government, and finally pull down its foundation, leaving it a wreck and a shambles. When the peoples of such a nation finally wake up and become aware of their oppressor, and thereupon take action to throw this parasite off their back, the Jew then raises up a loud cry of persecution. He manages to make the defending nation seem to be the culprit rather than the parasite. Usually, this will evoke the sympathy of the neighboring nations, who will then, in sheer stupidity, unwittingly come to the aid of the Jew. The recent example of this happening to the heroic German people is by no means the first nor the last in the history of Jewish duplicity. The same thing has happened in Egypt, to Babylon, to Persia, and recently to the Arabs in Palestine. 23. In order to get elected, it is necessary to cater to the nigger vote. It is most pathetic as to how many people have been tricked into swallowing this Jewish lie. Most of the time, we are given no choice between candidates, but only a choice of the lesser of two evils. The Jews see to it that the stable of candidates that they field is always such that all are espousing policies detrimental to the white race and advantageous to the Jews and the niggers. The white race still constitutes the majority of the population of America. If we ever did get a good and courageous candidate who came out with a platform clearly and loudly championed the cause of the white race, such candidate would be elected by a landslide. Through their stupidity or cowardice or both, we have never had such a candidate appear on the public scene, or at least not with enough energy to be heard by many people. It is our duty to field not only one such candidate, but a whole army of such candidates, working in coordination all across the land, under the unifying banner of the Church of the Creator, with a clear and far-reaching program of expanding the white race and shrinking the colored races, driving the race traitors from power and grasping control of our destiny into our own hands. 24. Driving the Jews from power would result in a tremendous bloodbath. This is not necessarily true at all. The German people drove the Jews from power in their own land with very little loss of life, very little bloodshed, and practically no turmoil. They did it legally, and they did it by means of the ballot. Contrast this with the tremendous misery and bloodshed that ensued when the Jews took power in Russia. During that terrible catastrophe, the country was torn from one end to the other. Agriculture and industry were destroyed. Famine ensued, and over 20 million of the best white leadership in Russia were murdered. We of the Church of the Creator believe that we can first of all save America, and that the white people can regain control of their own country by legal means. We can do this without much bloodshed if we follow the program laid down in the creed of our new religion. The first and foremost problem is to straighten out the white man's thinking, as I have said so many times before. However, should struggle and bloodshed become necessary, then we too must pay this price and use this means. If necessary, we must and will invoke the highest law of nature. We must and we will use all means and every means necessary to ensure the survival of our race. If we don't drive the Jew from power, it is almost certain that a gigantic bloodbath will ensue, in which 60 million of the best white Americans will be murdered. 25. The Christ is not a Jew. Confusion. This silly argument has become one of the favorite pastimes of the kosher conservatives in recent years. I have read countless arguments pro and con on this subject from people like Gerald L. K. Smith and many others who should and undoubtedly do know better. This is such a tricky and meaningless argument, yet one that gets a lot of simpletons who should know better booby-trapped into believing that if we could only prove by some devious means that he wasn't a Jew, that per se would vindicate that he was something great and special. In the first place, there is not a shred of evidence that such a man ever existed, and overwhelming evidence that he did not exist. I have gone into this more thoroughly in another chapter entitled Christ's Existence Not Substantiated by Historical Evidence. However, if we were to take the Jewish script writers who wrote the New Testament at face value, then it is overwhelmingly clear that the Jews are telling us that Christ was one of theirs. In the very first chapter of the New Testament, namely Matthew 1, it gives the supposedly full lineage of Jesus Christ from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, on down to those whoremongers of Judah, David, Solomon, and others, to Joseph, the father of Christ. Furthermore, in Luke 2:21, it says plainly that Christ was not only a Jew, but he was a circumcised Jew. Going still further, it makes very little difference whether he ever lived at all, whether he was a Jew, or whether he was not a Jew. Any way you slice it, the Christian teachings are bad, suicidal advice, and the Christian religion is bad news for the white race. History has shown that it destroyed the great and beautiful Roman civilization. We only have to read the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5, 6, and 7 in Matthew, to find out the nature of the suicidal advice that destroyed the Roman Empire when it embraced Christianity. 26. The white people are the true Israelites. This argument is really treacherous and seems to especially hook those people that want to be Bible-believing Christians and at the same time have discovered what an evil race of people are the Jews. Since their Bible tells them that the Israelites are the chosen people of God, and that it would be absurd for God to choose such an obviously evil, treacherous, and perfidious race as the Jews. Therefore, by some twisted rationalizing, if they could only put themselves in the place of the Israelites, it would make the whole biblical mess more acceptable. Consequently, when somebody comes along and offers them a ridiculous cock and bull story that we, the white race, are really the true Israelites, they jump at this nonsense like a fish at a baited hook. The whole proposition is so ridiculous that it is hardly worth repudiating here again. However, I will bring up a few salient points that should demolish this silly nonsense once and for all. In the first place, it is only the Jews that practice circumcision, and this is their brand and their trademark. It has been historically so from time immemorial. Secondly, it is part of their own creed, as they have stated, was set forth in God's covenant with Abraham. Thirdly, the Jewish Bible makes it quite clear that Christ and the apostles were Jews. Fourthly, when you read what kind of murderous, whoremongering, treacherous scoundrels were their great patriarchs and so-called men of God, such as Judah, Abraham, David, Solomon, and many others, the question arises, why would any self-respecting white man in his right mind even want to be a descendant of such shabby and disgraceful scum? 27. But we are all human beings, not animals. This shallow and meaningless argument comes up most often when talking about how Christianity, with its suicidal teachings, not only violates common sense, but also the laws of nature. To love one's enemies, to turn the other cheek, to resist not evil, to give away everything you have, and other such nonsense is completely contrary to the laws of nature. Nowhere else in nature's realm do we find any creature practicing such obvious means to its own self-preservation. When I have pointed this out, I have often met with a silly argument that we are not animals but human beings. When asked just what this is supposed to mean, it is hard to get a clear answer from these people, but evidently they mean to infer that we are immune from the laws of nature the other creatures are subjected to. We are evidently supposed to be exempt from the laws of nature because, they say, we are given the ability to think and reason, that we have a soul, that we have everlasting life, and many other such non sequitur arguments. The facts of life are somewhat different from what these arguments would imply. The fact is that we are a creature of nature, just as is any other of the millions of nature's creatures that inhabit the face of the earth. We most certainly are not immune from any of the laws of nature. If there be an idiot who thinks we are, for instance, exempt from the laws of gravity, let him try and jump off a 20-story building and see how exempt he is. Whereas it is certainly true that we have a higher intelligence than other creatures of nature, this in no way whatsoever immunizes us from any of the laws that govern the universe. We are born just like the other creatures. We procreate just like the other creatures, and we die along with the rest of them. We must eat and drink and breathe just like the rest of the creatures of this universe. The laws of heredity apply to us just as rigidly and just as relentlessly as they do to horses or cats or rabbits. If there are some misguided dreamers who would rather think otherwise, that is their problem. I didn't invent the laws of nature, nor the laws of gravity, nor the laws of heredity, nor did I invent the realities of life and death. That is the way it is. That is the way it always will be, and those are the facts of life. In any case, it is when we foolishly deviate from the laws of nature that we run headlong into trouble. It is when we no longer trust our own intellect and reasoning and begin to have our minds unhinged by unreal, unsubstantiated and unnatural teachings, that we begin to reap havoc with our own lives and imperil the existence of our own race. We cannot escape the conclusion that we are indeed a creature of nature, as are all others. Although we are the highest creature of nature, we are nevertheless subject to each and every one of nature's laws, no less, no more so, than any other creature. 28. You shouldn't take the Bible literally. Many a time when I have cornered someone in a debate about the impossible and contradictory tenets of Christianity, they will try to weasel out with the expression, "Well, you shouldn't take the Bible literally." Evidently, they are inferring that the Bible doesn't really mean what it says and doesn't say what it means. This again, in itself, is a strange and idiotic non sequitur argument. If the Bible is such a great piece of literature, and is the divine word of God, certainly Christ and or God, with all their supposedly infinite wisdom, were capable of expressing themselves clearly and explicitly. The fact that the Bible is just saturated with contradictions, with a vast collection of vague and meaningless phrases is in itself the best indication that it is, of course, not the Word of God or any such thing. In any case, if I, as a businessman, were to write a contract selling a piece of land and then, when it came time to deliver deed and title, blandly stated to my customer that, well, of course, you shouldn't take what it says there too literally, I would, of course, be accused of being a liar and a cheat. If we can't take the Bible literally, and it doesn't mean what it says, and say what it means, then what does it mean, if anything? Since the so-called good book makes such a big issue of truth, we can, of course, judge it by its own standards. If it isn't telling the truth, if it doesn't mean what it says, and if it doesn't say what it means, then it is, of course, lying. 29. The term Western civilization, a misnomer. Not too many people have caught on to this tricky little bit of deceptive Jewish dialectics. The term Western civilization has come into such general use that everybody takes it for granted without analyzing the hidden deception. The civilizations that the world has witnessed over the last 6,000 years, including today's civilization, are not at all Western as such, but are white civilizations. Everywhere that civilization has appeared, it was created by the white man, as we have explained in greater detail in another chapter. And so it is with today's civilization. Whether the white man resides in Europe, or in the United States, or in Australia, whether he gets a foothold in Hong Kong, or in India, or in China, he builds a civilization. We should therefore make the important distinction that civilization has nothing to do with Western or Eastern hemispheres as such, but is strictly the creation of the white race. Therefore, by calling it Western civilization, the Jew has robbed the white man of his due credit and confused the origin of the creator of our civilization. Civilization is exclusively the product of the white man and no other. 30. There are good Jews and bad Jews. In discussing and debating the merits and demerits of the Jews, I have had a lot of so-called intellectual sophisticates come up with a barrage of confusing distractions about good Jews and bad Jews. Some will make the silly claim that the present-day Jews are not the real descendants of the biblical Jews, the inference being that the biblical Jews were, of course, God's chosen and were good guys. But today's Jews have been mongrelized from the Khazars and are a different breed of Jew, admittedly bad. Others will make the distinction between the Kikes and the good Jew. Another distinction that comes up repeatedly is that there are the communist Jews and the non-communist good Jews. Another distinction is the Zionist Jews and the non-Zionist Jews. The latter, evidently, are supposed to be all right. The list seems to be endless, and the only effect of it all is to get the Jew off the hook and to confuse the issue. Getting back to the biblical Jews or Israelites, the Old Testament says very plainly that they all practiced circumcision.
Whatever new blood they have taken into their race over the thousands of years, the fact is the practice of circumcision is their brand or trademark today, as strong as ever. Whatever changes there have been in their blood, they have strictly kept their loyalty to their race, their dedication to their deadly conspiracy of world domination and the destruction of the Gentile. They practice racial loyalty today as fervently as they ever have. Their conspiracy for the destruction of the Gentiles has not changed. It is therefore completely pointless to waste any time about the finer distinctions as to which are Hebrew Jews or which are Khazar Jews or Sephardic Jews or any other kind of Jew. As far as the white man is concerned, in his fight against the Jew, a Jew is a Jew, and every one of them is a mortal danger to our existence. They are all bad Jews. Every Jew has been indoctrinated from his childhood in the principles of Talmudism, and his main obsession throughout his life remains to destroy the white race. Therefore, let us never forget that all Jews are our enemies, and to distinguish between one type of Jew and another type of Jew is as useless as distinguishing between different types of rattlesnakes. If you have been bitten by a rattlesnake, it makes very little difference what his genealogy is, whether he is a diamondback or a sidewinder. They are all poisonous. 31. We are here to help others. This is another, one of those insane so-called Christian principles that has had a devastating effect on disintegrating the white race. What it really means is that unless you are helping somebody else that is less fortunate and more useless than you are, you have no particular purpose in being here. The idea is, of course, silly and contradictory on the face of it. A very good question that even a little child might ask is, then what are the others here for? The answer, obviously, is nothing, and they are perfectly useless. The further conclusion would then be that our only purpose is in helping to promote and expand the useless, and in most cases of so-called Christian charity, this is absolutely true. The whole principle of Christian charity is to proliferate the scum and the colored races, and to destroy the productive element of our society, especially the white society. We of the Church of the Creator completely reject this nonsense. We go back to the source of all truth, namely the laws of nature, which say that we are here to propagate, advance, and expand our own species, our own kind. We believe that in doing so, we are fulfilling the highest law of nature and the highest law of the universe. It is neither good nor charitable to keep promoting and proliferating the lowest elements of our own race, but it is absolutely suicidal and a perversion of the laws of nature to help promote and proliferate the colored races, who are, by their own volition, our enemies. We believe in going back to the basic principles of our creed and our religion, namely, pursuing that which is good for the white race, In so doing, we are also in harmony with the highest law of nature. This law plainly tells us that we should converge our efforts on the goal of propagating, preserving, and advancing our race, at the same time opposing and destroying those elements that are a threat to us. 32. If we would only develop more understanding between the races, we would all get along beautifully. In their zeal to pursue understanding, many white do-gooders who join the Peace Corps, the Communist Party, and many other liberal Jewish organizations have heaped a tremendous amount of damage upon their own race. Because they have not been able to see through this Jewish deception of so-called brotherly love and understanding, they have become exceedingly useful tools in the hands of the Jews. The fact of the matter is that those people who have had the least to do with the niggers are most easily duped into promoting the race-mixing program instituted by the Jews. It is those people that have had to face the realities of life by having to work with niggers, have had their own neighborhood invaded by an influx of niggers, those who have had the unpleasant experience of seeing these refugees from the jungle at first hand, that become rapidly cured of any utopian ideas of race mixing. On the other hand, it is usually some wealthy white do-gooder who in many cases never really had to work for a living, but inherited his money, and who more or less lives in an insulated ivory tower type of existence, that becomes the most ardent of bleeding hearts promoting the Jewish program of race mixing. The better you know the niggers, the more you understand them, the more you know and understand the Jews, the more you realize their true nature. The more you understand them, the more you realize what a deadly threat they are to the existence of the white race. The more you understand them, the more certain you become that they really are your enemies. 33. Separation of church and state. The kosher conservatives keep telling us again and again what a wonderful constitution we have. They especially remind us how wise were our founding fathers for insisting upon the separation of church and state. Upon examining this concept closer, I fail to see any great merit in separating these two important pillars of our social structure. It does not make too much sense to have the same group of people supporting the defense of their country with military service and tax dollars, and then go to church on Sunday and preach resist not evil, turn the other cheek, and love your enemies. It does not make any sense to spend billions on educating our children and then teach them a judge not in Sunday school, telling them to abandon their good sense and judgment. Nor does it make any sense for the government to promote business and prosperity when the same people who support such government preach sell all thou hast and give it away. Nor is there any great merit to have most of the white people of America divided into 1,000 different factions religiously, and we should be united in a solid front against our mortal enemy, the perfidious Jew. I believe that a far more ideal situation is that combination whereby the government of the white race is blended in perfect harmony with its religion rather than in conflict with it. A religion should unite a race and not divide it, and only upon a unified racial religion can the solid foundation of an enduring government be built. Once we have religion, government, and race all blended in a unified philosophy for the welfare of our race, we will have secured the future of the white race for all time to come. 34. The we can't win phobia. Probably one of the toughest problems I have encountered in leading the white man back to sane thinking is overcoming his defeatist attitude. Countless times I have heard, "Yes, I agree with everything you say, and I am 100% with you, but can you convince the rest of the white people?" This is, of course, negative, defeatist thinking, and is not to be tolerated. If you are in a paddle boat, a mile offshore and sinking, you don't just sit there and contemplate what your chances might or might not be. You do the only sensible thing. You start bailing and paddling for land, as if your life depended on it, which it does. The situation of the white race is very similar. Rather than idly contemplate odds, we must dig in right now and aggressively pursue the fight to straighten out the white man's thinking. This is our main problem. If you believe in the program as set forth in this book, then 100 million other white people can also be convinced, provided you start spreading the word today. Once we have straightened out the white man's thinking, our problem is as good as solved. The problem of overcoming the Jews and the niggers and regaining control of our own destiny. In fact, all other problems will seem like child's play in comparison. 35. Love and hate. Hate is a normal, healthy emotion with which nature has endowed all of its higher species. It is a fundamental and vital emotion necessary for the preservation of the species. To emasculate the white man of the ability to hate those that are a threat to his existence is like declawing and detoothing a tiger and then throwing him back into the jungle to fend for himself. Defenseless, such a tiger would perish miserably in short order. So it is with the white man. If his healthy instincts are tampered with, and he loses his ability to hate and fight those that would destroy him, he is left naked and defenseless before his enemies. The perfidious Christians, who so loudly proclaim their abhorrence of hate, themselves practiced hate to the ultimate. When someone disagreed with their belief or creed, they branded them as heretics and had them burned at the stake, hanged, or otherwise destroyed. They hated fiercely and one way or another made short shrift of their enemies. Love and hate go together. If you are willing to protect those you love, then you must hate those that threaten their security and existence. Most great movements in history are built on hate. Hate for the enemy. Hate for the dire threat. There is nothing that unites a group more firmly than hate for the common enemy. Nor is there anything that spurs them on to determined action more decisively than hate. 36. Juggling figures and statistics. According to the 1970 census, the United States, as of April the 1st, 1970, had over 203 million inhabitants. Of this number, it claims approximately 11% are black and 3% are Jewish. From this, it would appear that the rate of growth of the nigger population had remained approximately the same as in previous years, and that the blacks were not increasing any faster than the whites. The evidence from many sources convinces me that the government is deliberately lying to us in order to cover up the true facts. This I am convinced they are doing in order to lull the white people into a false security. They want to deceive us into believing there is no racial time bomb ticking away in our midst. One does not have to be an especially astute observer to note that the black, unmarried broodmares, subsidized by public welfare, are breeding uncontrolled. They are having as many as 12 to 16 illegitimate black bastards each, and a black population explosion is in our midst. The fact is, the niggers are breeding like rats, whereas the white families are conscientiously and deliberately suppressing their own reproduction to one or two children per family. I therefore am convinced that the black population is in reality probably at least three times as large as the government would like to have us believe. I have no way of telling, but I would guess that the truth would be nearer 35% of the population in America is now black. In other words, approximately 70 million out of the 200 million, instead of 11% or 22 million. Likewise, I believe that the Jewish population is much higher than the Jewish government would like to have us believe. Instead of being infested with only 3% or 6 million Jews, I would guess the correct figure would be close to 20 million Jews in America. On a worldwide basis, the Jews give us a variety of figures regarding their own numbers. Oft-quoted figures are 18 to 20 million. Again, I believe that these figures are kept deliberately low in order not to alarm the white Gentiles. Again, I have no way of telling, but I would suspect there are at least 80 million Jews infesting the face of our planet. In sum total, what with Filipinos, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, niggers, Jews, Indians, and mulattoes breeding and multiplying at an ever-increasing rate in the country built and founded by white Europeans, I would say the white population of the United States today is down to approximately 50% of the total and shrinking rapidly in relation to the colored scum. It is therefore high time that we, the dispossessed majority, took action to save ourselves from being dispossessed of our land, our property, and our country. To this end, we creators are dedicated not only in America, but on a worldwide basis. 37. Real estate versus stocks and bonds. There are thousands of different ways of investing money. However, basically, there are only two major avenues, either in real estate or in stocks and bonds. When you invest your money in stocks and bonds, you are basically a spectator, trusting to the management of the corporation and payment of dividends thereof to some other party or parties who are in control. In most of the major corporations of America and the world today, that control rests in the hands of the Jews. When you buy land or improved real estate, you yourself are in control. In fact, you have a monopoly on that portion of the world that you own. It is unique and it is irreplaceable. In the final analysis, all our wealth rests on land, on real estate. In the last 10 years, whereas in the stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has gone up only 18%, the average price of land, acreage, city lots, resort property in the United States has soared 95%, a rise 3 times as great as the general price level, and 5 times the Dow Jones Industrial Increase. In many select areas, such as Florida, land has done much better. Whereas stocks can be maneuvered up and down daily, with the Jewish-owned stock exchange manipulators reaping profits on both the up and the down movements, land relentlessly appreciates in an ever-upward spiral. Not only are the Jews in complete control of the stock exchanges of the world, but they control or own most of the shopping centers and key real estate in the major cities. However, vast quantities of tremendously valuable real estate are still in the hands of white Gentiles. It is therefore the relentless goal of the Jews to drive the whites from the ownership of all land and improved real estate. Whereas stocks and bonds, which often can become worthless, are highly touted as securities, there is a vicious and unending campaign to discourage the whites from owning real estate. This they do by propaganda, taxes, financial manipulations, and dozens of other devices. They have spelled out this goal of depriving the white people of their land in the protocols. It is therefore the experience of my lifetime that the white man should strive to acquire, as early as possible, all the land and improved real estate he can, and keep its possession in his family. They don't make any more land. Likewise, the white man should band together to boycott the Jew in business. He should, if possible, go into business for himself. Having built up a thriving business, he should never, never sell out his business, but pass it on to his own family. In no case should he ever sell either his land or his business to a Jew.